Welcome, everyone, to the virtual John Jay Homestead and our 2021 lectures, the first one. I'm Lisa Bale, trustee of the Friends and chair of the lectures committee. We do think we have something to add to the conversation during this unprecedented time, and we're glad that you agree. First, some webinar logistics. You're all muted, and video of you is turned off, you audience members. If you have technical problems, please use the chat function for messages to your host and our ED, Emily Grand. After an introduction, Ms. Biskupic will talk, and then we'll entertain as many of your questions as we can get to. Please send those to us by the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. Now, this is a very different year for us, as of course for many others. A disadvantage is that we can't see each other and can't join at a lively dinner afterwards. One advantage is that we have a bigger and wider group than we could have in our beautiful ballroom. The grounds of the homestead are open, however, and we invite you to take advantage of our park and trails and our website to see what we're doing to stay exciting and relevant to you. Special thanks to our lectures committee for their generous support of these talks and to our excellent public partner, the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation for everything. And as always, and most important, our members who are our reason for being. There's another advantage of Zoom too. We're about to offer you a short survey. What kind of case do you think will present the biggest challenge to Chief Justice Roberts in the next year? We'll share your results at the beginning of the question period following Joan's talk. Here it comes, please vote. It's multiple choice. Hold on, I just lost my thing. It's multiple choice, there's no right answer. And if you change your mind over the course of the talk, that's not a problem. Our upcoming events, please watch for our next two talks. On February 9th, James Shapiro, Columbia professor, director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, scholar in residence at the Public Theater with Shakespeare in Divided America. And on March 16th, Brenda Wineapple, award-winning author and professor at CUNY, the New School, and Columbia with The Impeachers about Andrew Johnson. We hope you'll join us to both of those. Now, those of you who've come to our talks before know that we always look for a J connection between the topic of the evening and the homestead. Tonight, I'm going to tell you a story about mob violence based on rumors in the press, riots resulting in multiple deaths, and the storming of government facilities defended by Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and others, a story with which Chief Justice Roberts opened his report on the state of the judiciary last January 2020. Thanks to our docent, Barry Abish, for making sure I don't mess up the facts, and here we go. In post-revolution New York, there was no legal way for medical schools to get cadavers for anatomy labs, so they relied on grave robbers, some of whom may have been medical students. This was an open secret, as long as the activity was limited to Potter's Fields or the Negro Burying Ground, no one complained. But in April 1788, it was reported in a newspaper advertisement that the body of a white woman, wife of a respectable working class man, may have been taken. People became enraged and started rampaging against groups of medical students and doctors who were taken into protective custody in the city jail, the secure location of the day. When rioters broke into the jail, Jay, then Secretary of Foreign Affairs, was hit in the head with a rock and knocked out. Then the militia opened fire, it turned into a full-on melee, and as many as 20 people were killed. Now, Chief Justice Roberts didn't tell this Jay story because he saw a year ago how resonant those facts would be this week. He used it to explain why there was such a long delay between Jay's first four contributions to the Federalist Papers, numbers 2 through 5, and his last, number 64. But sadly, he's wrong on the dates, and it is a little fun to correct a justice. Jay did write only five of those essays, and there was a long gap, but the riots happened in April after he published number 64 in March, and the delay was vaguely described by Jay as being caused by another ailment. We do, however, welcome the chief's regular references to our own chief, another one in this year's State of the Judiciary having to do with Jay's competent management of the courts during his own yellow fever epidemic, but that's a story for another time. Now our speaker, Joan Biskupic, is currently a full-time legal analyst at CNN, having previously written for Reuters, The Washington Post, and USA Today. She was a finalist in 2015 for a Pulitzer in explanatory journalism and has written well-received books about Justices O'Connor, Scalia, and Sotomayor. She's a lawyer with a degree from Georgetown and lives in Washington, D.C. It is my pleasure now to give you Joan Biskupic.
Thank you, Melissa. And I really appreciate everyone who has popped on this call when there's so much else happening right now. And I hope that those of you who are watching live and those of you who watch the tape will appreciate a little bit of a history and background about our Chief Justice. And I think it's great that Melissa, you and your team are keeping Chief Justice John Roberts on his toes when it comes to John Jay, because John Jay is one of his favorite subjects for those year-end reports and generally. So first of all, I also want to say, in addition to thanking people for being here, I hope everyone is safe. This is such an unusual time with the pandemic, but also with all the violence that we've experienced recently here in Washington and that is feared for Washington and the state capitals across the country. So let's just keep our fingers crossed and pray for the best all around. I want to start with a letter that Chief Justice John Roberts wrote when he was only 13 years old. He was applying to a private Catholic boarding school in Northern Indiana, where he had just moved with his family. And it was written on December 22nd, 1968 to the school headmaster. And it's the school has preserved it under glass. And it's the only visual I reproduce in my book. "Dear Mr. Moore, the main reason I would like to attend La Lumiere School is to get a better education. I've always wanted to stay ahead of the crowd, and I feel like the competition at La Lumiere will force me to work as hard as I can. At an ordinary high school, it would probably be easy to stay ahead. I realize, though, that going to La Lumiere will be a lot of study and hard work. I feel confident that these labors will pay off in large amounts when it comes time to applying for college. I'm sure that by attending and doing my best at La Lumiere, I will assure myself a fine future. I won't be content to get a good job by getting a good education. I want to get the best job by getting the best education. Sincerely yours, John Roberts Jr." Now, I use this letter in my book and I start tonight's talk with it because I think so many of the themes that emerged with 13-year-old John Roberts have carried through his life, a real quest for perfection, a drive, preparation, homework, all themes through his life. And also just trying to, if there is a best route, as he says, rather than just the ordinary route, he'll go for the best route. My book overall devotes chapters to that early life, his childhood, and then his career, his young career. And then once he's on the bench, some of the highlights I hit that I'm happy to take questions about: his switches in the Affordable Care Act case, two of those, his positions on race, which I consider to be the most enduring legacy of John Roberts, and now his control on the divided Supreme Court. I essentially began reporting this book when I was working on the two of the prior ones for Justice Antonin Scalia, a book that came out in 2009, and Justice Sotomayor, the book that came out in 2014, because during those years, the chief had just started in his position, and it was great to be sort of picking up on the side all sorts of information that helped form the ideas I had to even decide to take on John Roberts. Just as a quick aside, all my previous subjects had had distinctive demographic factors. For example, the first woman on the court, the first Italian American, the first Latina. And some publishers weren't interested in John Roberts back in 2015 and 16 when I was pitching this topic, thinking, who cares about him? He's just some white guy. Well, turned out a lot of people care about him. And my timing turned out to be pretty good. When I started writing this, Anthony Kennedy was still on the court. Justice Scalia was alive. And John Roberts was sort of navigating between the liberals and the conservatives in a way that he didn't have as much control as he did as soon as Anthony Kennedy left. And then, of course, we have the additional situation of on September 18th, when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away and has been succeeded by Amy Coney Barrett. And I'll give you a little preview at the end of some of my thoughts about that. But first, who is John Roberts? He was born in Buffalo, grew up in Northern Indiana. And as a child, an aunt said he was so darn serious that he was known fondly as Sober Puss. He racked up A's and became an academic star, shaped especially by La Lumiere, this all-male Catholic boarding school. Students took Latin all 4 years, along with calculus and college-level work. Jacket and tie were required, and his classmates told me at 8 at night, John would be studying. At 8 in the morning, John would be studying. He ends up graduating first in his class. The labors certainly paid off. And then he goes to Harvard. He's the first student from that school who gets admitted to Harvard. He does college there in only 3 years rather than 4, and then goes to Harvard Law School. And one thing I want to stress is when he was there, he actually didn't like the atmosphere. It was too liberal for him. You know, remember, we're still, he gets there in the early 70s. We're still in the post-Vietnam protest era. And he was turned off by some of that. But by the time he graduates from law school in 1979, the nation is on a cusp of a change, the Reagan Revolution. And he goes first to be a law clerk with Judge Henry Friendly of the Second Circuit up there in New York. And then he lands a prestigious clerkship with then Associate Justice William Rehnquist. At that time, Rehnquist was still an associate rather than the chief. And he's in his last few months of that clerkship when he hears Ronald Reagan's inaugural speech in January of 1981. And John Roberts says, "I felt like he was speaking right to me. I felt the call." With the help of Rehnquist, who connects him with Ken Starr, for those of you who have followed a lot of contemporary events, you'll see Ken Starr keeps emerging through the John Roberts story like crazy. But anyway, it was Ken Starr who first hires John Roberts in the Reagan Justice Department. So he works first for the Reagan Justice Department and then the White House Counsel, and then he goes on to the George H.W. Bush administration. And in those positions, he develops the scaffolding for his views that then will eventually play out on the Supreme Court. And I say that there's a direct line from that legal work that he did then to his positions at this, in the center chair that he now sits, especially on race. He was, even though he was a junior lawyer there, he really embraced and spoke for the conservatism of the day. He was attuned to the administration's messaging on race, and he sometimes would complain of colleagues who were not all in. Yet, John Roberts was no firebrand. He has always sounded eminently reasonable. He still carefully prepares for all public appearances, like the star advocate that he was when he was in private practice and when he argued for the government as a deputy solicitor general. He ended up arguing 39 cases before the court, and several justices said they considered him the gold standard. As John Roberts himself sometimes quips, he got better once he became chief because they wanted to give him that accolade. He first went on the bench in 2003 as an appeals court judge appointed by George W. Bush. And then 2 years later, when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announces that she's going to retire as an associate justice, President Bush chose John Roberts. And this is what President Bush wrote about John Roberts in his own memoir in 2010. Beyond the sparkling resume was a genuine man with a gentle soul. He had a quick smile and he spoke with passion about the two young children he and his wife Jane had adopted. His command of the law was obvious, as was his character. One of the top aides to George Bush at the time, to whom the president turned for advice, happened to be Brett Kavanaugh. And Brett Kavanaugh told Bush, as he was deciding among Samuel Alito, this is back first before Alito eventually gets on, between Samuel Alito, John Roberts, and Michael Luttig, was which man would be most effective as a leader of the court, the most capable of convincing his colleagues through persuasion and strategic thinking. And President Bush says that's what tipped him to choose John Roberts. Now, this is back in July of 2005. So he makes the nomination. John Roberts starts to meet with senators. All sorts of courtesy calls are going on. He's doing his murder boards, as they're called, in preparation for his Senate appearance. And on September 3rd, late August, Hurricane Katrina slams into New Orleans. The storm surge overwhelms the city's levees, floods many neighborhoods. The Bush administration is under so much criticism for bungling the federal response, delaying help for the region. You know, more than 1,000 people are dying, end up dying in this. And in the middle of the Katrina catastrophe on September 3rd, Chief Justice William Rehnquist dies. Now, everyone knew he had been ill and from thyroid cancer. And when the Bush administration actually filled the first spot, they weren't thinking of John Roberts for the chief spot. They were thinking, okay, you know, he's only been on an appeals court for 2 years. We'll put him in the Sandra Day O'Connor spot. We'll think of someone older and more senior for the chief position if and when the chief dies. Well, he dies so soon after that, in the middle of Hurricane Katrina. George Bush is so feeling the criticism from the Katrina event that he doesn't want anything more controversial to his life. So he says, on the morning after they've all discovered that Chief Justice Rehnquist had died, I'm going with John Roberts. I'm not going to consider Antonin Scalia, who had been a little bit in the mix as a potential candidate to be promoted to chief. He wasn't going to consider Michael Luttig at that point, and he wasn't going to consider Samuel Alito. He was going to go with the man who, in just a few weeks between when he was named in mid-July as a candidate for an associate justiceship, had so impressed senators and continued to impress the president. So that's how he gets the position. As I'm sure many of the viewers today remember, he talked about being an umpire, just calling balls and strikes, but that's not what judges do. The Constitution is a very open-ended document. There's a lot of room for interpretation. And early on, Chief Justice John Roberts showed himself to be solidly in the right wing. He was part of the narrow five justice majority that does the Citizens United case in 2010 that lifts all sorts of campaign finance regulations. He's part of the majority that decides the District of Columbia versus Heller case, which for the first time said that there was an individual right to own guns under the Second Amendment. And then most defining, I believe, was his 2013 opinion in the Shelby County versus Holder case, where he really cut back on a very crucial section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that had required cities and states with a history of race discrimination to first get permission for any voting rights electoral changes. So, you know, his first 5 to 10 years, he's very much over on the right. And Justice Kennedy is there. And Justice Kennedy is the one who's exerting a moderating influence. And he would often shift to the liberal side, certainly on social policy questions, which would then prompt John Roberts to take a strong position in dissent. And the most conspicuous of those came in 2015 when he protested the majority's decision that declared same-sex marriage a constitutional right. And for the first time ever, John Roberts decided to voice his dissent from the bench. As many of you know, that usually they just give us a written dissent, but if a justice feels passionate enough about what he or she is saying, it will be read from the bench. And the chief has only taken that dramatic step once, and it was in the Obergefell versus Hodges same-sex marriage case. He complained that the majority was infringing on an issue that should have been decided by elected legislators. He said, just who do we think we are? This is a court, not a legislature. We have to say what the law is, not what it should be. And he also compared it to Dred Scott. That's how strongly he felt about this case. But then Justice Kennedy steps down in 2018, and he's no longer about, the chief is no longer going to be a major dissenter. He's going to control everything. When Justice Kennedy steps down, he's succeeded, of course, by Brett Kavanaugh, who's more to the right, and no longer would the chief have to sort of cabin his own conservatism because of Kennedy. He can essentially decide cases. But it comes, this control comes with a catch. We now have Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is acting as if anyone who's appointed by him or another Republican president would automatically rule with him, whereas any Democrat would rule against. And John Roberts has a great stake in the integrity of the court. And he needs to consider not only where he would be on a case, but what would be the message to the public. And we know that he tried to counteract President Trump back in November of 2018, when the president criticized a jurist by saying, oh, he's an Obama judge. And the chief put out a statement saying, we don't have Obama judges. We don't have Bush judges or Trump judges. What we have are judges trying to be neutral and consider each case as it comes. So then he had to sort of put his money where his mouth was, and he did. John Roberts is a much different justice today, or I should say from Justice Kennedy's departure to last summer when Justice Ginsburg passed away. He really had to take into account where the liberals were much more than he had before. And part of the research that I've done since the book came out in March of 19 was times when he switched his votes, when he navigated to join the liberal members to counteract or get ahead of any criticism that it was just this straight 5-4 conservative liberal court. One case that I discovered he had changed his vote at the 11th hour on was the census case, when the Trump administration was trying to add a citizenship question to the case. And Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said, we need to add this to help enforce the Voting Rights Act. And the chief was ready to go along. It was a 5-4 vote initially to allow Wilbur Ross and the administration to go ahead and add the citizenship question, which challengers thought would definitely decrease Hispanic, new immigrant participation in the census and ultimately, you know, hurt urban areas in terms of their counts for both apportionment representation in Congress, but also federal financing. So he does that. And then in the term that just ended this summer, he was plainly at the ideological center, and he exerted unprecedented control over cases, as well as over the court's internal operations that had to change because of COVID. So the chief, for the first time in his tenure, that dates all the way to 2005, he votes to strike down a state law that diminished access to abortion. That was in a Louisiana case. And he also rules against the administration in the Dreamers case. It says, look, he says, the administration could have changed immigration policy, but it didn't follow the proper procedures when it did it. So there was another one where he ruled against the administration with the four liberals. And perhaps in the most awaited ruling related to President Trump, he shepherded a 7-justice majority to reject the president's extensive claims of temporary presidential immunity. So, you know, he does all this, and he was in the majority more than any other justice. So that meant all his views prevailed more than any other justice in the private sessions. And he used the full power of his position as chief and his place at the middle of the ideological spectrum to shape these opinions. And I felt like what we saw was a justice who was finding new ability to calibrate his views and build coalitions in a way that we hadn't seen before. And not only did he control in cases that were decided, he also influenced what cases would be taken up. Among the many mysteries of last session's final days were why the conservatives stopped pressing for a new firearms case that would allow them to bolster the Second Amendment. This is a big priority of many of the justices on the right. And after they had heard this one New York guns case that washed out his moot, they had about 10 other cases that they could have taken for this term. But what I found out was that his conservative colleagues just didn't trust him to give them the fifth vote. It requires four justices to vote to grant a case, but five to decide it. And they decided, we're not gonna get the chief. He might not be with us, so we can't. Why once again go through the process of having a new gun case teed up if we're not gonna get a fifth vote? But I will have to say that what happened on September 18th, when Justice Ginsburg passed away, changed so much, especially on the Second Amendment, because she was then succeeded by Amy Coney Barrett, who has staked out a much more conservative view on the Second Amendment and other real flashpoint issues, that could change things, and it might change, frankly, how the chief then navigates that. And, you know, here's what I'll say about the swap of Amy Coney Barrett for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Not only is she obviously a conservative, where Justice Ginsburg was this liberal icon, she is farther to the right than the chief, than Brett Kavanaugh, and maybe even Sam Alito. Her prior views, at least, have aligned much more closely with Justice Clarence Thomas. So we will eventually see what she does. Now, several of my colleagues in the press have said John Roberts is now irrelevant. Amy Coney Barrett will be the deciding justice. But I have said, do not write this man off yet. You know, he is so tactical, he's so smart, and his powers of persuasion are deep. And he still has the power, the authority as Chief Justice to assign any opinion, who would write it, you know, the author of the opinion, when he is in the majority. So I expect that he will vote more with the right wing, just so he can control it. Finally, I just want to close with another point of history, kind of where Melissa began, that refers to his own attitudes and approaches of what he wants to, how he would like to be seen as he goes forward. Before he was a law student, he thought seriously about earning a PhD in history at Harvard. And he's remained a student of history. And this is what he has said. You wonder if you're going to be John Marshall or if you're going to be Roger Taney, referring obviously to the forefather of judicial review, and then also to the chief reviled as the author of Dred Scott, which said slaves were not citizens. And John Roberts continues, the answer is, of course, you are certainly not going to be John Marshall, but you want to avoid the danger of being Roger Taney. And maybe, just maybe, he would like to have the influence of John Jay, but for longer years on the court. So I welcome your questions, including about the Affordable Care Act as it was decided before and as it might be decided now this session when they have the new case, or anything else related to Chief Justice Roberts, our newest justice, or the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Thanks. Can't hear you. There you go. Melissa's muted.
How about that?
That's good. Okay, great.
Better? Yeah, that's a little better. Apologies. Thank you, Joan, for that fantastic overview. And as I promised, we're going to lead off with the results of our survey. And what I see is that the question is, what do we think is the type of case that's going to present the biggest challenge for Chief Justice Roberts? And we can define that however we want. And 36% of people said Affordable Care Act.
Ah, good.
said Roe versus Wade or more generally women's health, and 17% said removal of a president. What do you think? Are we wrong? Are we missing something?
Oh, in fact, the participants hit on many exact topics. And one part of my presentation that I cut out at the end, just because I wanted to get to the questions because they're always so much more fun, has to do with the Affordable Care Act case. And let me just tell the viewers why I don't think that's going to be as big of a dilemma. They heard the Affordable Care Act case on November 10th. And it was a question of, it had many parts to it, whether the challengers had legal standing to bring it, now that the penalty for not having insurance has been zeroed out, can we still call it a tax the way the Chief Justice had rationalized it back in 2012? And if that one provision involving the individual insurance mandate goes down, does the whole sweeping, thousand page law go down? That is a huge question. But I have to say, having heard the justices on November 10th and knowing where the chief had been in 2012 and 2015 when he upheld it, I think that there's no way that this court is going to strike down the entire Affordable Care Act. And it's likely what the most likely scenario is for the justices to say, all right, the individual tax, the individual mandate is not a mandate because it's not tied to the tax penalty as it was before, but just cut that part out. And that would not change anything in your daily lives at all because that had been cut out in 2017 anyway. The more crucial question is, should this whole thing go down? And during oral arguments, the Chief Justice, Brett Kavanaugh, and Justice Barrett all raised questions and made remarks that would suggest they do not want to sink the entire Affordable Care Act case. So that issue could essentially be resolved early this year. And then if the Supreme Court were to do anything dramatic, we have a Democratic president now and we have a Democratic Congress. So there could be some remedial legislation. So I think that topic will not turn out to be as difficult as it has in the past. But I do think reproductive rights, Roe versus Wade, those are going to be very tough cases. The chief did for the first time last session vote to strike down an abortion law, but his concurring opinion essentially changed the standard, the legal standard, and would make it easier for states to have more regulations of abortion. And then the folks who said religion is a big deal for the majority on this court. The justices as a group, including Roberts, maybe not as robustly as his very conservative brethren, want more exemptions from the law for religious believers. So I think that's going to be the kind of case that could, those the kinds of issues that we'll see many, many more very divisive rulings in the end.
I was expecting more people to go in with voting rights. That was what I was gunning for. You don't think that that's challenging? You think it's too easily settled, or you think it's not going to present because of the where we are in the calendar, or what do you think?
It's almost the last, for sure the last, because this is an area that John Roberts has owned voting rights. He has done in almost every ruling, he has curtailed the reach of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And now they for sure have a majority to do that. They did before. John Roberts was the one who controlled the Shelby County decision, and it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent that, just as an aside, I'll tell people, she got the nickname of Notorious RBG. It was because of her dissent in Shelby County that went viral, that NYU law students started calling her the Notorious RBG as a play on the late rapper, the Notorious B.I.G. Mm-hmm. So it was that Shelby County case, but she was in dissent. He already had a majority. So Melissa, this court is already very strong in a position to say, We're not going to interfere with state regulations of the polls, and we're not going to interfere with newly drawn districts that might be challenged as hurting minority rights. Mm-hmm. And he's got room to spare now with a sixth conservative.
Okay. All right. Here is a question from an anonymous attendee. You have said that Roberts rules differently as chief than he would if he were just an associate justice on the bench. If Ginsburg had been chief, do you envision this liberal icon ever crossing the aisle and voting with the conservative justices in order to preserve the image of an impartial court? If so, on what kinds of cases? That's what we call a counterfactual.
I love that question. I love that question because indeed, I have said that about Chief Justice John Roberts in part because he's said it, that he believes he has inched to the left because of his position as chief. Boy, RBG, you know, okay, so she comes on. Well, actually, this is interesting. If she had become Chief Justice back in 1993 when she was first nominated, or let's say that she happened to be elevated to chief, I do think that she might have moderated in some ways, and I'll tell you why. Her first set of years, first of all, her time on the DC circuit, she was known as a much more moderate jurist, and even some women's rights groups and civil rights activists, she did not want Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They were pushing more for a woman by the name of Pat Wald, who was much more of a liberal jurist on the DC circuit. So she had a record of being more cautious. And then in her early years on the Supreme Court, she was no firebrand. You know, on the VMI case, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, women's rights issues, yes. But on many other things, she was not out there with very strong dissents. What changed was in 2010, when she became leader of the liberal wing, she then she embraced that role and moved more into this strong, robust voice of the left in a way that she had not done before. So that gives us a little bit of a clue that she was adaptable. And if she needed to be a chief justice who didn't want to just challenge everyone at every turn, I could see her trying to be a more moderating influence in some cases. Now, let's remove women's rights and equality cases. Perhaps in some business cases, she would have, you know, been a little bit more caught. Maybe, you know, tried to build more coalitions there. And, you know, I have to say on criminal law cases, she was not, she's no Sotomayor. So let's just put it that way. There were areas in criminal law that she definitely separated herself from Justice Sotomayor on. And I'll give you a perfect example, even on the Equal Protection Clause. When the Dreamers case came up last summer. That's the one, you know, some people call it Dreamers, some people call it DACA, but it's the deferred action for children who came here without papers when they were young and have gone on to get jobs and go to college. There were two parts to the challenge to that case. One was some of the challengers said that the Trump attempt to roll back President Obama's priority here violated the Administrative Procedure Act. But others also said that that it also violated the constitutional equal protection guarantee. And because of how, you know, how racist his rationale had seemed. And Justice Ginsburg went along with the majority, with the chief's decision, that wouldn't even entertain the equal protection argument. Whereas Justice Sotomayor separated herself from that majority, even with the other liberals, saying, don't brush off the equal protection claim here. But she was the only one saying that. So yes, Justice Ginsburg could move to the center more at times. I love that question.
So, and that's a segue to another question, which is,
Should Justice Breyer retire, or do you think he will, or do you think that he'll see himself as the leader of the more embattled liberal wing and that'll encourage him to hang in there?
I think he's going to go. I mean, that this comes from no firsthand information, but I did a story recently that referred to his earlier life as a Senate staffer and his understanding of the politics of judicial nominations. And once the two Georgia races were settled, and we now see that the Senate will have a Democratic majority, that strengthens President Biden's hand when he makes his judicial nominations starting, you know, this spring for lower courts. And so I think that Justice Breyer would be more inclined to go sooner rather than later. I mean, he could wait until 2022, but once you start to wait, you get into any kind of crazy territory close to, for example, the 2022 midterms, and, you know, perhaps something happening with the Senate, and you just don't know what Mitch McConnell, you know, we have seen scenarios play out since Mitch McConnell blocked Merrick Garland's nomination in 2016. And I think that Justice Breyer just wouldn't want to take such a chance. The other thing I would say is Justice Ginsburg used to say to me, you know, who are they going to get who's more liberal than me? Because she was feeling a lot of pressure to step down. President Obama had invited her to lunch in the Oval Office. Yeah. And, you know, so many liberals were saying she should step down while he had a Democratic Senate, or while he, you know, while there was still enough of a cushion to go. And she was like, no, I don't, you know, you guys get your own house in order. She expected Hillary Clinton to be elected in 2016. And this was her life. Justice Breyer, I think, is much more attuned to the political winds, again, because of that Senate background. And he has a lot of outside interests. You know, in fact, you could probably get him as a speaker, frankly.
All right, you'll help us.
Because he loves all sorts of civic engagement. He's been on Zoom more than just about anybody else since this pandemic started, giving speeches to places, and he's interested in architecture. He's written books. He's got many, many interests, and he's going to be 83 in August. So I think he's considering that, you know, he still has more years to do a lot of interesting, fun things, and maybe he doesn't want to spend his time on the court right now. But we'll see.
Okay. Here's another hypothetical case.
Okay.
Our friend Hugh Price. Assume Trump pardons himself for any and all federal crimes. Further assume that he's prosecuted for bank or tax or securities fraud, or for a substantial and provable role in the recent insurrection that is less tricky than the incitement free speech issue. In light of your comment that the Constitution is an open-ended document with lots of room for interpretation, how do you think Roberts and the Supreme Court would handle Trump's likely defense that he pardoned himself from all federal crimes, including particularly heinous ones like aiding and abetting insurrection and sedition?
Okay, it is a great question. And let me first say that the pardon power does seem uncabined for the president, although it only applies to federal crimes. So, you know, the Southern District of New York can go after him no matter what. Obviously, there's a very strong school of thought that says, even though there appears to be no limit on the president's ability to pardon, no person can sit in judgment of his own case. So of course he shouldn't be able to pardon himself. So there's a very real question here. And it would, the questioner cuts right to the chase. It would only be tested if he ends up being subject to some sort of indictment and conviction. And then he'd say, well, too bad, I've been pardoned. That's really a tough question about what John Roberts would do. I have written that John Roberts seems destined to be shattered by Donald Trump for many, many years. It won't be all over when he reads Joe Biden the oath of office on the 20th. And I think that, okay, this is what I would say generally of how John Roberts might look at something. First of all, he is a very strong believer in executive power. He's one of the members of the court who had a strong background in the executive branch. He tends to tip toward the idea of a unitary executive. So we would start with that basis. The next question, though, is he might think this is a one-of-a-kind question. It's never, ever going to come up again. And Donald Trump has been so egregious in office, and whatever they managed to, let's say they truly find grounds to convict him, you know, for whatever this heinous offense is, he might not want to put himself on the line for this former president. I can't say definite one way or another, but you know, there's so many times when I've thought, oh, that will never happen, and I don't think that at all anymore.
As with lots of things that are happening, we thought would never happen. Talk about clerks. Do justices ever look for ideological balance in their clerks? And what about Josh Hawley?
Right. That's a great question of the day. I've gotten so many reporters have called me for comment on what do you think the Chief Justice thinks of Josh Hawley? And I've stayed away from it because I'm not going to put myself in the chief's brain on this one. But I will say, Josh Hawley was hired by Chief Justice Roberts early on in Justice Roberts' tenure. So, you know, remember how I was saying that early on he was much more with the right wing than he is now? I think that kind of hire, somebody who was clearly more ideologically bound to the right, might have been one, you know, that would have been a more common pattern for him at the time. Josh Hawley had been a law clerk to Michael McConnell, who's now a Stanford University law professor, but had been on the 10th Circuit at the time. And he was very much of a conservative. Although coincidentally, Michael McConnell had clerked for liberal William Brennan. So, you know, all sorts of associations that defy expectations here. But many of the justices right now on the court who are on the right hire from lower court judges who are on the right also. The chief, however, right now is trying to get some balance. So in any given term, he could have hired someone who at one time had worked for Merrick Garland, or could hire someone who worked for Jeff Sutton, who is a Republican appointee, a George W. Bush appointee on the Sixth Circuit. So the chief right now is looking for ideological balance. There was a time in Justice Scalia's life that he always liked to bring on one liberal just as a start, you know, kind of a sparring partner. But right now, most of them are going with people who are in their lane.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's at all possible that justices over the course of their tenure will swerve and change ideologies, or that the world will change around them? How do you think that's working these days?
Well, okay, so I'll take two examples of Justice John Paul Stevens and Souter. You know, they both were appointed by Republican presidents, and Justice Stevens is a little bit of a tough customer because it's not that he was ever, you know, far to the right. It's just that he was much quirkier and less predictable in his early years. And then he became very solidly with the left wing. So he used to say to me, he didn't think he changed. He felt like the court changed. But I also gave a lot of weight to the fact that he was several years, leader of the left wing, just as I had described Justice Ginsburg. And that's a role that the senior justice of either side takes very seriously and feels that he or she has to really keep the troops together on particular issues. But Justice Stevens would be one person who either changed himself or experienced a very, very changing court as he moved to the left. And then Justice David Souter, who prompted the mantra "No more Souters" in his first term or so, first or second term after his appointment in 1990, he certainly moved to the left. But in a lot of ways, I felt like he hinted at that during his confirmation hearing back in 1990. He gave such an expansive view of due process and 14th Amendment liberty that I thought that he could have ended up where he was. It's just that it was much more to the left than probably anybody would have predicted.
Here's one question that says, aren't most decisions actually 9-0 or 8-1? Is there really a big difference between the conservative and liberal justices on most cases?
Absolutely right. On most cases, on the cases that, easily half the cases plus some are going to be 9-0, 8-1, maybe 7-2. But those aren't the cases that play exactly to the questions that Melissa asked at the outset in terms of the issues that really capture the public's attention, where the rubber meets the road, the Affordable Care Act, 5-4, religion disputes, almost always 5-4, some of the toughest criminal capital punishment cases, 5-4, the powers of the president, 5-4. So the justices themselves really subscribe to the idea, stop making us look so divided, because we are unanimous many times. And I don't dispute that. And I definitely don't dispute the premise of the question. It's just that for the ones that seem to matter most to the public, and especially on the separation of powers and what a President Trump was able to do. You know, when you think of the travel ban case from 2018, that's 5-4. The big labor case, the Janus ruling that came out right before Justice Kennedy left the bench, that was 5-4. You know, the gay rights case, 5-4. So yes, they are together a lot. But on a lot of the toughest issues in America, they predictably split along ideological lines.
So who do you think is going to be the power justice going forward?
I think that's a terrific question. My vote, frankly, is still with the chief. I think the chief still has enough power. And if you were only to step back and look at the court along an ideological spectrum, it would be Brett Kavanaugh at the middle. And I think he's too new. He's got too many other factors that would be at play to seize control of the center. I think that Justice Kagan is a power player in many ways, even though she's only one of three justices on the left. She has worked a lot with the chief and Justice Breyer. In fact, that I would, just to make clear to everybody, I will be really sorry to see Justice Breyer leave. I think that he has, he's always been so civic minded, and he is one of the justices who does believe in compromise. What he says is he doesn't like to dissent. He doesn't want to write a dissent. He thinks a dissent is a failure because he would rather compromise. He'd rather give up something. Justice Alito, as a counterexample, doesn't like to really give up much. He doesn't like to have to navigate and negotiate, you know, I'll give you this if you give, you know, if you return the favor here. But that's one of the sort of characteristics of Justice Breyer. So if we're not sure yet how things will shake out because we haven't seen enough of Justice Barrett, but the Chief, Justice Kagan, and Justice Breyer were all ones who wanted to bring some unity to more unity, and to go back to the question about, aren't they closer together than sometimes are portrayed in the press? In the Trump documents cases, the chief worked very closely with Justice Breyer to try to get that 7-justice majority on the Trump documents cases. Mm-hmm. And both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh gave in a little bit too, so that they could sign on. It was only Justices Thomas and Alito who dissented fully from that pair of rulings.
Okay, a return to an earlier topic.
Okay.
saying the presidential pardon seems inappropriate for a democracy, sounding more like something that comes from the divine right of kings. Why not get rid of it? Or how could we get rid of it? Where does it come from?
All right, it's in the Constitution, so it would be a lot of work to get rid of it. And, you know, just on that score, I think that some of the rationale behind that question has a lot of validity when you think of how President Trump has used his pardon power. His very first pardon was of Sheriff Joe Arpaio out in Arizona. And he was convicted of contempt of court because not only was he engaging in racial profiling as he was picking up Latinos at the border and detaining them without grounds, a judge had told him he couldn't. So he flouted that ruling and said, I'm still going to do it. So he's convicted of contempt of court, which goes right to sort of the power of the judiciary. And President Trump pardons him right away in August of 2017. And then we've seen how he's used his pardon power mostly for cronies. Now, you know, other presidents have done that at times, but that would be something that would be very hard to change. Now, if we ever did get a ruling on the breadth of the pardon power through the scenario that another questioner had raised, that would be a way to cabinet, but it was put in there with the idea that, you know, mercy, clemency is sometimes required. So we've seen how it was used through the years and for good, certainly. You know, people who had served their time and had given back so much to society that a president felt like that person needed to be rewarded in some way, or the turmoil of the draft dodgers who went up to Canada and elsewhere. And Jimmy Carter said, you know, we're not going to litigate this anymore. Yeah, it's a blanket pardon for everyone who could potentially be charged in any way for leaving the country and dodging the draft. So there have been good things in many people's minds that have come of the pardon power, but they're not staring us in the face right now.
Mm-hmm. One more question. I'm going to try to fit in two more. How do you think his background with father, a Midwest corporate leader, and graduate of an independent private Catholic school creates values and character which influence him and his rulings?
Yeah, John Roberts has had a very charmed life and, you know, great. I mean, you know, probably many people on this Zoom seminar have, and there's nothing to begrudge him that he came from a well-off family. He had a superior education. When I was writing the book, I would often think, boy, if John Roberts were writing this, this would be really good. He has a wonderful writing style. He loves history. He's completely engaged in all sorts of topics that the John Jay world would love to penetrate. He's been part of that, and he really has not had much disappointment in life, and that's a good thing for him. But who he has right to his left all the time is Justice Sonia Sotomayor saying, remember what it's like for lots of other people. She did it in a case today. She does it all the time on racial issues, on poverty issues, on criminal defense issues. And I think it's really important for someone who's had a privileged background to be able to put himself in the shoes of others. So I'm very receptive to the kind of question that is raised here about someone who might, you know, have lots of markers in the corporate world, being able to understand that a workforce needs representation, that employees sometimes just can't show up because of all the problems they have getting there, you know, to think of the disadvantage. You know, when we were, there have been cases about being stopped by the police, you know, all the time, or cases about being tracked by new devices. And it was almost as if it was harder for some of the conservatives, including the chief, to put himself in the shoes of people who would be, you know, sought by police until it got down to like tracking somebody on their cells rather than, you know, following them in a, you know, because their rear lights were out. So that's, I think that the best judges necessarily can sort of look at the facts of a case and the law and try to remove their own personal, you know, preconceptions.
I'm afraid we have run out of time. So we're going to thank you for your generous time tonight, and we're going to stay in touch and follow you, and you're going to tell us how this is all going to unfold. And we'll ask you in a year whether you would write the book differently by the end of next year. Thank you so much. And we hope for all the audience members that you'll join us for our other talks later in the winter, and see you all and stay safe.
Thank you, Melissa.